Hey everybody, Chris Lindsay here, and you're listening to Pitch List. Join us on a deep dive into the heart of what makes writing songs and making music so magical. Let's find out what makes songwriters tick, and along the way, remember why we love music. Welcome to Pitch List. Hey everybody, and welcome to the fourth season of Pitch List. It sounds crazy just saying it. It's hard to believe we are on our 56th episode. I want to stop and thank everyone who listens, and also the American Songwriter Network. I hope you have enjoyed the show as much as I have. So we're back, and we've already got a strong season underway, and we have some amazing guests coming that you will not want to miss. We're starting off with a bang this year. I got to sit down and talk with songwriting and recording legend Bill Anderson, aka Whispering Bill Anderson. Bill is a Nashville institution. He has weathered decade after decade, cranking out great songs all the way. As far as longevity, I can't think of anyone who could match him. For us mortals, it's hard to imagine staying in the game and relevant for 53 years. He has seen it all and done it all, from giant crossover hits to the Country Music Hall of Fame, and he is still down to earth and approachable. When you're done with the show, I urge you to go to AllMusic or Wikipedia and take a journey through his career. It's amazing. Here's Bill Anderson. Good afternoon. This is Chris Lindsay, and you're listening to Pitch List. Wow. I am honored to introduce our guest today. Honored. I want to please welcome Bill Anderson, an absolute legend in country music. How are you, Bill?
I'm doing well, Chris. Good to see you. How are you?
I'm fantastic, man. I've been excited all morning to talk to you. I really have.
Thank you.
You know, I've been a writer a long time in town, and you know, all of us look up to you for really the longevity of your career and the varied nature of your career as an artist and a writer. And anyway, it's just absolutely a thrill to have you on the show, man. Thank you.
Well, it's nice of you to say that. Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So I'll start out with, I was going through your career the last couple of days. Is this true that your first cut was City Lights by Ray Price, right? Was that in 1958? Is that true?
No, that was not actually my first cut. That was the first one that anybody ever heard.
Okay, all right.
Actually, Ray was not the first person to record City Lights. I recorded it first on a little label out of Texas called TNT Records.
Wow.
Bill, and Chet Atkins heard it. And Chet actually produced a record on City Lights by an artist named Dave Rich on RCA. And the way Ray Price got the song was he heard Dave Rich's record on the radio.
No kidding. So what? So that record was charting with Dave Rich, and then Ray Price was a huge star at the time, right? And
oh yeah, the record was not charting by Dave Rich. It was just okay. It was just being played on the local station. The story, Chris, and you'll appreciate this being a songwriter and knowing how things happen accidentally a whole lot of times. Ray Price and Ernest Tubb were riding to the golf course, and Dave Rich's record of City Lights came on the radio in a little AM local radio station in Nashville. And Ernest was actually listening to it, I think, a little more closely than Ray was. And when the record was over, Ernest turned to Ray and said, son, you ought to record that song. And Ray said, well, I've already got my next single recorded. You know, everything's lined up for it and all. And they said all the way around the golf course that day, every time they would get on the green together, Ernest would say, son, you need to record that song. And I've often wondered if Ray recorded the song because he liked it or if he recorded it to shut Ernest Tubb up. Wow. Ernest was badgering him about it. But I've wondered many times what would have happened had that disc jockey not played that song at that moment, had Ernest and Ray not been listening. I mean, it was just one of those great big old God winks that jump-started a career for a guy named Bill Anderson.
You know, and I think a lot of people have those stories of one little event in their life that led it. But, you know, also, what do they say? Fortune favors the bold also. So you just keep swinging and then you get that moment. I did read that you were still in college at that point. Is that true?
Yeah, I was. I was at the University of Georgia, which I am.
There you go. Bulldogs.
Go Dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was working at a little radio station about 20 miles north of Athens in a little town called Commerce, Georgia, and going to school in the mornings and playing country music on the radio in the afternoons.
Unbelievable. So you felt quite fortunate at that age to break as a writer. Then again, you were really prolific and really good. I've heard you talk about that. I think I remember now when you won the Icon Award at BMI, I believe you spoke about that, right? About that cut.
Yeah, I'm sure I did because, yeah. You know, everybody's got that cut that is kind of the jumping off. Got that first one or the first one that, you know, hits big for you. And I was lucky to kind of have both at the same time. So whenever I talk about songwriting, I have to talk about City Lights.
Yeah, well, it's an amazing song. So, and now I want to go to number two on my list, which is after that, you wrote and recorded Still, which became a giant hit for you, right?
Yeah, it was about 5 years later, but
right.
Yeah.
and that was, and I knew this, but I didn't know the extent of it. That was a big crossover hit for you, right?
So, well, they used to tell me to go pop with a mouth full of firecrackers, but I did. I think around number five in the pop charts and number one in the country charts, and changed a whole lot of things in my life, I can tell you that.
Oh, well, that's huge. I mean, that's absolutely huge. And you had several hits after that were crossover hits also, right?
Well, two or three of them kind of
Yeah. Down
in the pop charts, yeah. But, you know, I never wanted to – I mean, it was wonderful, and I appreciated it and was grateful for it and all. But, I mean, my heart was never anywhere but in country music. I had no aspirations of being a rock and roller or a pop singer or a pop writer or anything. I just wanted to write those plain old three-chord hurting country songs.
But it's amazing how those songs can still become popular in all genres based on the arrangement. I think the arrangement of some of those songs at that point were sort of cosmopolitan, you know, and maybe that's what helped them. But still, we want to say that accomplishment of having a country hit that crosses over to other genres is rare, and it's a major thing, man. It's not often that it happens.
No, it doesn't. It happened a little more, I think, maybe back then than it does now, mm-hmm. Late 50s, early 1960s. And you mentioned the arrangement. I don't want to go any further without saying that I was so fortunate, Bradley, for so many years. And Owen is the one that came up with the arrangement on Still and created the sound of it all. And it would have never happened without him and his genius and his input.
Well, that's nice of you to say. Yeah, he's got some statues to him in town, too.
And they're all well-deserved.
Yeah, it was before my time, but I know all the stories, and it's amazing. So then, as I'm going through your bio, TV game show host. You did some TV work, too, after that, right?
Well, I look better on radio, but I've yeah. Career has been the craziest thing, Chris. Things have, people say, well, now what kind of a plan did you have? I had no plan. My whole career has just been flying by the seat of my pants, and somebody calls up and says, hey, you want to be on a game show in California? And I'm thinking, well, I don't have anything better to do. I might as well. And, you know, it's kind of like what's behind door number one, door number two, and door number three. And I would knock on them, and they'd open. And that was just one of the doors that opened. And I spent, probably 4 or 5 years of my life back and forth, going from Nashville to California, doing the game shows, hosting game shows. I ended up with my own show on ABC for a while. And then when the Nashville Network came on, of course, I came back to Nashville and hosted a game show over there. So, again, it was just one of those things that happened. It wasn't something I set out to do at all.
Yeah, But you may be a little humble there. You were also really good at it, and probably someone saw that you would be good at it. Did you, during that time when you're working in TV, I know that's a heavy schedule, did you also find times to write songs as you worked on those productions?
That's a really good question, because I kind of had a dry period. I was on these television shows. We're talking 78 into the early 80s. And in the early 80s, I kind of got away from songwriting for a while. And I was hosting the game show on the Nashville Network in those days and still touring and things. The music was changing, and I wasn't real sure I knew how to change with it. And I was doing these other things. And I really took about 10 years. I mean, I didn't sit down and say, hey, I'm going to take 10 years away from songwriting, because I couldn't do that. But I just didn't write much. I had a couple of things in the charts in the early 80s, and then I didn't really get back into writing until the early 90s when I came back and called co-writing. So while I was, to answer your question, really, while I was doing the game shows and soap operas, I was on a soap opera for 3 years.
Wow.
Live on ABC. And during those days, I don't know if it just wasn't time to write. I don't know if I just didn't have my mind in it, didn't have my heart in it, but I didn't do very much writing. And I'm so glad that some things changed in the early 90s and I started writing again.
Yeah. Well, and maybe things work out the way they're supposed to work. I know when I came into town mid 90s, you were co-writing. I did. And then Whiskey Lullaby, when did that come around? Was that late 90s or was that 2000s?
We actually wrote, John Randall and I actually wrote that in 2000, but okay, it sat on the shelf for about 5 years. Everybody was scared to record it.
You know, I know I've heard that story and I get it, because, and it's still around right now, is this hesitation on Music Row to touch these topics that might be sad or difficult, or, you know, really their real life, that things that happen to people. You know, you having the longevity of your career, what are your thoughts on that? Being there when country music really could be raw and immediate and real, to where we moved into that period where there were taboo subjects, you know, the drinking, smoking thing.
I feel like, and I've said this many times, I feel like I got to Nashville at absolutely the perfect time. I got here in the late 50s, kind of on the tail end of what I call the hillbilly era. They were still strapped, these fiddled to the top of the car and riding down the highway, you know, five or six people crammed in a Cadillac or a station wagon in the days before the buses. And I got to see it go from those days into what we referred to in those days as, you know, the modern era of country, 60s, 70s, and into the 80s in there, and then see all the changes that came along in the late 80s into the 90s, and then, goodness gracious, the mammoth changes that have come along now. So I have just been so blessed to have gone from the really early raw era, as you called it, of country music, hillbilly music, up to, you know, what we're experiencing today. And there's an old gospel song called "I Wouldn't Take Nothing from a Journey Now," and that's how I feel. I wouldn't take nothing from a journey. I've had a ball.
Yeah, and it's amazing. And you know, one thing I think is, as a writer, I'm hitting about 25 years here in town. You know, it's pretty easy to burn out. You know, it can be easy to get frustrated because your career goes up and down, you know, as a writer. And what's your secret, man? How have you stayed at it and stayed engaged? And so you have such a positive attitude. And I try to keep a positive attitude too, but I know how hard it can be. And there are so many changes. Do you know what I mean? I mean, what's your secret to that? Do you have one?
I've never really tried to write for anybody but me. In other words, I've never tried to write for the charts. I've never tried to write for the disc jockeys. I've never tried to write for any particular artist. I've never tried to write for a trend. I've just kind of tried to be true to myself and write what I have felt like writing. And it finds a home, it finds a home. Some of them have found a home, and I got a bunch of orphans. And never will find a home. But I think when you do that, when you try to write and just write the best song you can write and throw it up in the air and say, hey, I hope it lands somewhere. But if it doesn't, I've done the best I can do. The whole joy of it to me is at the end of the day saying, I think we got all, or I got all the idea that was in there to get out, and I'm happy with it. I hope somebody likes it, but if they don't, then we'll go on and do the next one.
Wow, that's a great answer. So if you're doing it for the love, you're always going to love it, right? You're never going to. That's a great answer. And I know that's true. It is easy to forget. Here's another question for you. Now, I know we're in a pandemic and we're all kind of, you know, hunkered down in our spaces, but under normal times, do you still write a lot, co-write a lot? Do you write weekly or monthly or daily?
I write very weekly. I mean W-E-A-K-O.
No, you know what I mean. Do you write every week?
No, not necessarily. I mean, there are weeks when I have written every week. There's weeks when I've written three or four times a week. It just varies. During the pandemic, I'll tell you something interesting that has happened with me is I got into co-writing after 25 or 30 years of writing nearly everything by myself. And early in the 90s, I got into co-writing and hardly wrote anything by myself. The pandemic has kind of turned me back inward a little bit. I've been writing some songs by myself, and it's been a real source of satisfaction to me for a couple of reasons. Number one, I got to wondering, and I think every writer will wonder this at one time or another, do you use co-writing? Am I using co-writing as a crutch? In other words, when I get to a tough place in a song, instead of digging down deep inside myself, do I turn to that guy sitting next to me and say, okay, you write this next line, because I'm not sure what to say. But if you're sitting there by yourself or writing in front of the mirror, you don't have anybody to talk to but yourself. And it forces you, I think, to maybe be a little more creative and to push yourself. And I have actually enjoyed some of the time that I've had alone in this last year or several months of being in the pandemic. I've just taken the guitar and sat down and written, probably 8 or 10, I think, fairly good songs just by myself. I've done some writing on Zoom. Steve Warner and I have written together a couple of times. I wrote with Brad Paisley on Zoom a song that he says he's going to record. And so I still like the co-writing process, but it's been so much fun to realize that after all this time, I can still go back and write a song by myself.
That's awesome. And that's a great use of the time. And I'm sure you feel connected to your past a little bit. And I think you're right. I think we can get a little lazy by having someone else. I'm not going to say it that way, because I think there's a magic in co-writing that can make a song better than it could ever be. But I know I hear you. I think I hear you. It's like when you're by yourself, it makes you stretch a little harder. It makes you push a little harder. I think that's a great answer. Another question I have, I got a bunch, but I'll hold it to an hour here. But as I was looking through your career, you have worked through many, many style changes in country music, right?
Yeah.
You know, I got to figure your perspective on it is just like better. It's going to be better than anyone's. I mean, literally from 60, 58, all the way to 2020. And, you know, not from the outside, but a person engaged, writing, having hits in every decade. You know, I just love to hear. I think everyone listening would love to hear you talk about the changes in the styles and how you feel about them and what you think about it.
Hey, you're talking to the guy who did country disco back in the late 70s.
I know. I listened to one of those records. It was awesome.
I've done everything from bluegrass to country disco. And again, I sound cavalier about this or anything other than just kind of telling it the way it is. I've never really tried to worry about the trends and the things that were going on. I mean, of course you're aware of what's going on around you and you want to fit in. But like when John Randall and I wrote Whiskey Lullaby, people weren't running up and down 16th Avenue saying, somebody write me a double suicide drinking song. You know, we wrote it because that was what we wanted to write and what we felt at the time. And I've kind of tried to do that throughout my life. I was reading the new book that Willie Nelson's got out with his sister, where they kind of talk back and forth about their lives and their music and their career. And I was surprised to read, and this just been within the last couple of days, I was surprised to read that Willie feels that very same way, that he feels like just, you know, writing for himself and what he wants to say and how he wants to say it. And then, you know, if it fits a trend, okay. If it starts a new trend, that's good too. I ain't saying that country disco caught on, but it worked well for me at the time. And it was something I enjoyed. I enjoyed doing that just as much as I enjoyed doing a bluegrass album and a gospel album and all the other things that I've done down through the years.
Well, I think that's fantastic. And you know what? There were a lot of cool country disco hits. I remember them. And, you know, it's all about the music is a delivery device, maybe, and the country part is the lyric, you know, and that sentimentality doesn't seem to ever change. Country music, probably all forms, just seems to kind of motor on and have a life of its own and how it changes, you know. And
the only thing constant about music is it's constantly changing, and you realize that and accept that and go with it.
Right, which is such great advice, and I'm sure you know some people too. I've had friends that have trouble with that, and you do have to go with it. You've had cuts with Brenda Lee, James Brown, Aretha Franklin. You are so, I don't know, humble and unassuming, man. You have had unbelievable cuts in your career.
Been very blessed. I really am. If anybody had told me back when I first came to Nashville on the wings of City Lights that I would write a song that James Brown would record or Aretha Franklin or Bing Crosby or Brenda Lee or Porter Wagoner or the Louvin Brothers, you know, the whole gamut there, I've just been so very, very blessed and very fortunate and very lucky.
Wow, I love it.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Pitch List will be right back.
Tell me about what you're doing now. I saw a new song on your website, Good Day.
It's a good day to have a good day.
It's a good day to have a good day. I saw that on your website. What a great song. So are you promoting that or is... What? Tell me about that.
Well, I'm not hiding from it, running from it. this was one of the early examples. Now, this was a year or so before the pandemic hit and everything. And it was one of the first things that I wrote when I said getting back and writing some by myself. I wrote this one by myself. And somebody, a friend of mine, told me that they heard an early morning DJ on the radio. You know how the guys will come on, hey, good morning, hey, it's a great day to have a great day, you know, that kind of thing. And this person said, that's got a ring to it. It said, it's a good day to have a good day. And I thought, yeah, it really is. So I got my guitar and started just messing around with it and wrote the song. And I went into the studio in January of 2020, with the idea of, hey, we're going to lay down some tracks. I took my band in, my road band, and I hadn't recorded with them in a long time. And I took my road band in. I said, let's record some, you know, some new things, pretty earthy things and all. And the only one we got tracked before they shut everything down was It's a Good Day to Have a Good Day. And I just happened to have a film crew there. I called a buddy of mine. I said, why don't you come out? I'm recording with my band. Let's get some video footage. We weren't really necessarily thinking of making a video, but what we ended up with was some really good footage of us actually recording the song. And then we edited in some It's a Good Day to Have a Good Day kind of fun stuff. The lady in the pink leotards dancing. Yeah. The little boy having a cup of coffee with his grandpa out by the side of the lake. Some things like that. So the song has got a very positive message. I think the timing is very good. I've had an awful lot of people tell me, you know, I love to video and love to listen to that song a couple of times a day. Kind of keeps me in a good mood. So, you know, music affects us all at different times and in different ways. And if this is a song that can make somebody smile and think some happy thoughts right now, we need all the happy thoughts we can get.
We sure do. It's a perfect song for these times. It really is. Here's another question for you. I was thinking about this. So through the breadth of your career as a writer, who are some of the writers that you really admired? And that would be people that we would know, or maybe some unsung heroes that we might not know. Could you talk about or tell us some names of people through the years that you just really admire as writers?
Oh, sure. I got to know Roger Miller when both of us were just kids, before either one of us ever came to Nashville. He was in Atlanta, and I was working right outside of Atlanta on a little radio station, and he was in the Army station down there. And we met each other backstage at a Grand Ole Opry show in a little place called the Tower Theater on Peachtree Street in Atlanta. And we would stand backstage. We were the local germs and spooks that stood backstage and drove everybody crazy. And both of us said, well, we wanted to be songwriters. And sing me what he'd written, and I would sing him what I had written. And I became a big, big fan of Rogers. We were close as brothers there for a long time. And of course, he came to Nashville and he helped me. He laid some groundwork up here for me and enabled me to come up here. But Rogers always been a hero of mine as a writer, as a performer, as a person, as a comedian, all the wonderful things he was. And Roger and I both discovered Harlan Howard about the same time. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story. Roger was over at my little apartment one night, and we had been seeing this name Harlan Howard popping up on all these records, all these songs. And we started wondering, who is this Harlan Howard? So Roger did a little digging and found out that Harlan lived in California. And so Roger got over at my house one night. He said, let's call this guy. I don't know Harlan Howard. He said, I don't either, but let's call him. So Roger got a phone number. And we called California, and Harlan answered the phone. And Roger said, can I speak to Harlan Howard? And the boy said, well, this is he. Roger said, well, this is Roger Miller and Bill Anderson in Nashville. We're going to have you assassinated. He said, you're writing too many good songs.
That's so amazing.
Harlan was one of my early heroes as well. And then, of course, on down through the years has been so many of them, I couldn't possibly begin to name them all. But, you know, the Bobby Braddock, you talk about an enduring career. Look at what Bobby Braddock has done. The Curly Putmans, I don't want to start listing them because I'm going to leave some. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Hugh Prestwood. I told Hugh that when I come back in my next life, I'm going to come back as him. he's one of my very favorite writers. And you notice he writes nearly everything by himself. And I'm a big fan of that. And there's so many great writers, and I've had the pleasure and the privilege over the recent years, 20, 25 years or so, of co-writing with so many people that I just admire tremendously.
Wow. Yeah, I've always been a huge fan. My father and I listened to Roger Miller. He's passed now, my dad, but I love everything about Roger Miller. I know all the songs. He was an amazing talent. And so you guys were just buddies. And so had you had any hits at that point?
No, neither.
Okay.
It was before City Lights. And I'll tell you an interesting thing. Back a while ago when you were talking about Ray Price recording City Lights, and I told you the story about Ernest Tubb, and Ernest was trying to tell Ray to record City Lights, and Ray said, I've got my next record already cut. The song that he had cut was a song that Roger Miller wrote called Invitation to the Blues, which ended up as the B-side of City Lights. Both sides made the top 10. Both sides won a BMI award. But Roger and I, it's so funny that we paralleled each other in so many ways. And then doggone if the first big hit that he had and the first big hit that I had were back-to-back on the same Ray Price record.
That's crazy. That's crazy. Isn't that crazy? Wow, and they were both hits.
Yeah.
Was he as funny in real life as some of his records?
Oh, funnier. I mean, he was one of the wittiest, most brilliant people I've ever been around. I could sit here and tell you Roger Miller stories until the sun goes down and never repeat myself. He was one of a kind.
Yeah, and the other names you mentioned, Harlan Howard, amazing. Hugh Prestwood, that song Remembers When. Oh my God, that song.
One of my very favorite. Anybody who's a songwriter, anybody who loves music and they're not touched by the song Remembers When, they ain't got any blood in their veins. They got ice water in there. And I left out, and I don't mean to leave people.
Oh, no, no, I know.
Hank Cochran. I didn't mention Willie Nelson and these great, I mean, there's just so many great writers. There's no way to just...
Yeah, no, no, yeah. I totally understand. There's a million. There's Christopherson. There's literally... you know, hundreds. What I really loved is what I got was the story of Roger Miller, because, you know, for our podcast, we have a lot of listeners of the podcast are starting in their songwriting career, you know, maybe just in college, or they're thinking, or could be further along in life and thinking about moving to Nashville. They have an interest in songwriting. And I think they love, and I've heard that they love the stories of people starting out, you know, you and Roger Miller, backstage Gurman people just wanting to be in the business, you know, to look at both of y'all's career and think, well, they were there at that point. You know, I think it's inspiring to people, you know.
Well, everybody has to start somewhere, you know, and Roger and I were so fortunate to run into each other and pick each other's brains. And, you know, I said I didn't do much co-writing in my early days. I did write one song with Roger. And, of course, Roger's the guy that had the great line about co-writing. When somebody said, Roger, do you ever co-write, or why don't you co-write? And Roger said, did Picasso co-paint?
That's a good one.
Roger and I have a song together that has endured. In fact, it's Jeannie Seeley's got it in her new album right now. A song called When Two Worlds Collide, that's been recorded by just about everybody. And that was one of the few co-writes I ever did, and one of the very few co-writes that Roger Miller ever did.
Wow. And yeah, what a great song. Well, let's talk about it. Was that a quick co-write? Did you guys get together for a few hours? Did it go over a couple of days? Tell us about it.
Oh, you don't know the story of this one, huh?
No.
Roger and I were going to San Antonio, Texas for a concert. And we were traveling, as you did back in those days, early 1960s, in his station wagon. And Roger had been wanting to write a song. There was a science fiction movie back in the late 50s. It was kind of the Star Wars of its day, a movie called When Worlds Collide. Yep. And Roger had come to me two or three times and said, let's write a song called When Worlds Collide. I said, Roger, that's the name of a movie. We can't write that. He said, why? I said, well, you wouldn't write Gone with the Wind, would you? He said, yeah, I would. He would have, but he came to me just before we take off on this trip to San Antonio, and he said, what if we said When Two Worlds Collide? I said, brilliant. That's fabulous. Let's write it. So we take off to San Antonio, and we were traveling with a young singer and songwriter friend of ours named Johnny C, S-E-A-Y, Johnny C. And we put Johnny up in the front seat under the wheel and said, drive, get us to San Antonio. And Roger and I got in the back seat with a guitar and a piece of paper, and riding down through Tennessee and Alabama and everywhere you get to San Antonio in those days, we wrote When Two Worlds Collide. And here's the funny thing about it. Chris, you got to realize in those days, there weren't any things as like cassette recorders. People didn't carry little things around to, you know, write songs down or record songs and remember them. And Roger and I were frightened and scared to death that we would forget that song. So we sat up all night in the car and singing that song back and forth to each other. I'd sing it to him, and he'd sing it to me. And I'd sing it to him, and he'd sing it to me, because we were afraid we were going to forget it. So we got to San Antonio about 8 o'clock in the morning, and we called a disc jockey buddy of ours named Neil Merritt. And Neil went to the radio station where he worked and got a tape recorder and came over to the hotel. And somewhere in the early morning hours, we finally got When Two Worlds Collide down on the tape and fell asleep and didn't wake up till later that afternoon. But that's how it was in the old days. You didn't have Walkman. You didn't have cassette recorders. You didn't have all these conveniences. And you certainly didn't have cell phones and these things the writers can use today. So when you had to remember it, you had to do it the best way you could. And that was the best way we knew to do it.
That's incredible. I had never thought of that. So you knew it was a big song and you were just deathly afraid you'd forget it, which you can do. I have, you know, it's easy. You think you won't forget something, but a couple of days later it can slip away, or the way you remember the melody is different from how it really was. Often I'll go back and listen to a work tape and go, oh, that, wait, I had that wrong, you know, and it's better that way too. That's an amazing story. So you guys were so paranoid that you might forget it, that you just sang it over and over till you could record it.
Well, there was no way to make a work tape. We had no way in the middle of the night, and we're in a station wagon. And, you know, in those days, a recorder, you had to plug it in. You had to have electricity. There wasn't any such thing as portable stuff like that. So, I mean, we were in the prehistoric days of songwriting, and that's the only way we knew to remember the song was just to keep singing it.
Unbelievable. And not to mention, recording equipment was expensive.
Oh, yeah.
Very expensive. Even into the early 80s, you know, before the digital revolution, you know, everything was cheaper back then. But if you put it up against a cup of coffee or, you know, relatively priced, that gear is very expensive, you know, and people didn't have it. Studio, you know, a studio that you can now have on a laptop with Pro Tools, you're talking about over $1 million worth of equipment in 1978. You know, an SSL console and a 24-track machine, a Studer. It's interesting. I don't think anybody today realizes how fortunate they are to have what they have, you know, for $300 on a laptop. So you're going from, you and Roger Miller are both doing a show together in San Antonio.
Yeah. I think we were like part of the opening act for somebody. I don't remember lining the show, but it wasn't us.
Well, if you think about that, you're hauling from Nashville to San Antonio in a station wagon. That's brutal.
Yeah. And I imagine we probably got paid the princely sum of $50 a piece, you know, but, to me, in those days, $50 for playing a show, that was a lot of money. I'd been working at a radio station for $50 a week, and here somebody was willing to pay me $50 a day. I'd have ridden anywhere they wanted me to go, and I did.
Yeah, especially when you love it and you get to play for a big or a good crowd. I was just thinking, man, that's a long haul to be in a station wagon. And
you have said something about three times. You've made the reference to if you love it, if you love it, something like that. I found a thing in a newspaper years ago, and I clipped it out, and I have carried it in my wallet until it just disintegrated, turned yellow, and fell apart. But it's something that I have based my life and my career on. And you say we got a lot of people listening that are maybe new writers, people wanting to get into the business. So I want to share this because you've talked about loving it. I found a little saying that said, find something you enjoy doing so much you'd do it for nothing, and then learn to do it so well that they'll pay you and you've got it made. That's loving it.
That's right. And that's the secret.
Nothing. And you'll stick at it long enough till you can get good enough that somebody will pay you. That's almost the secret to life. Enjoy what you do. I mean, it's like the old thing, if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life. And that's one reason that I've done what I have, because I've never felt like it was work. I mean, sure, it's the way I made my living, and I enjoyed it, and I still continue to enjoy it. But if that love hadn't been there, I don't care how much determination and commitment and everything else you've got, if you don't have that love, if it's not in your heart to do it, then you may just be barking up the wrong tree.
I agree. Preach it, brother, because it's honestly too hard to do it if you don't love it. You know,
it just
literally is. I mean, I hate to say it so plainly, but especially the artist road, it's just too hard. You know, you can't have a sick day. You're traveling constantly. You're a politician. You're always on. You know,
it'll drive you to drink.
Yes. And so you have to love it. And my old publisher, who's gone now, Johnny Slate, I don't know if you ever knew Johnny, great writer, kind of a wild man, but a genius. I kind of learned a lot from him, and he told me if you do it for the love, the money will follow. And I think that's the same type of thing you're saying. Well, man, I could talk to you forever and ever and hear every Roger Miller story you have, every Harlan. And I know there's Harlan Howard stories, and I know there's Mel Tilla stories.
Yeah,
I know. I think what I'd love to do, Bill, is maybe we wrap it up today because I've taken up a lot of your time, but maybe we do a part two in our next season and catch up and get some questions from our listeners for you. Would you be up for something like that?
That would be fun. I would enjoy that very much. And in keeping with everything else that you said, and these names keep coming in my head, let me get in the modern world a little bit, talking about all these writers. I didn't mention Mel Tillis's name, and I also did not mention Loretta Lynn. I didn't mention Dolly Parton.
Dolly.
There were a lot of came on. Tom T. Hall. I mean, my goodness, how many great writers and writer artists that I was so privileged to know and to work with, in the early days. I would love to do a part two of this and doing questions that people would send in. That would be fun.
That's what we're going to do. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about?
I just want everybody to know that it's a good day to have a good day. So go have one. I've had a good day, Chris. I've enjoyed visiting with you. Thank you for letting me take up some of your time.
Well, it's been an honor, sir, and thank you for being on Pitch List.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Pitch List, produced in partnership with the American Songwriter Podcast Network. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or your preferred listening platform. And if you want, feel free to leave us a 5-star rating and review. For exclusive content from this week's guest and more, you can visit our website at pitchlistpodcast.com or follow our social media pages on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. To hear songs written and or recorded by today's guest, check out this week's playlist by finding us on Spotify at Pitch List Podcast. Plus, don't forget to let us know on social media what songwriter, musician, or music business professional you want to hear from next. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.